Josh McDowell speaking on Justification by Faith Defined.
Now we're in a transitional period. I know, I'm not a good artist. I got the man a little too high. Now we start out in Romans 1, 18 to 32. And we showed that the bad man, the guy with the black hat, or the pagan, was without excuse before the law court. Paul, again, the great prosecutor, brought him before the law court, showed them, not theologically speaking and teleologically speaking, within his conscience and in the universe around him, there is a witness of God. And if he responds to the light that is given him when he comes to God consciousness, God will move all heaven and earth in the Western Union to get the message to him. But what happens to the bad man is that he does not even try to self-justification route or anything else. He just completely neglects God and goes on living in his sin. So he's without excuse. Then, Romans 2, 1 to 16, we see one of the two types of Jews, which here we call the moral man, the man with the white hat. This man here says, now just a minute, Paul. I haven't done all those horrible things, the 19 in the list at the end of Romans 1, the heathen does. Certainly God's going to accept me. I'm trying my best. And he goes on in, and his response is self-justification. But then we saw why he is without excuse. Because he's actually doing the same thing that the heathen was doing. And he's going to be judged according to truth. Not what he thought it would be. Not what his professor said. And he's going to be judged according to works. And not by faith. He is without excuse. And then Paul brought before the bar of justice of God the religious man, the Buddhist, the Confucius, and he specifically chose the Pharisaic Jew, because if he dealt with a Jew, then all others would be less applicable or less acceptable as a religious solution. And so he started with the top, the Jews. And he showed, even though they had been given the oracles of God, that they were condemned. Because they depended upon outward ritual, baptism, circumcision, prayer, synagogue attendance, in order to have acceptance with God. So he went on self-righteousness, was his response, self-righteousness. Producing his own righteousness through circumcision and other things. But he was shown to be condemned because he had not had an inward change. And God looked at the heart. Now, if the religious man did not suppress the light that he had by outward ritual, eventually it would lead to an inward change. He would be inwardly changed. However, he suppresses the light by trying to produce his own righteousness by ritual. This was so many people today who say, well, I want to clean my life up first. You ever heard that? I need to make some things right in my life, and then I'm going to come to Christ. But you know, that person almost never comes to Christ, because actually, what is it that keeps the religious man or the moral man from accepting Christ? One of the two reasons. Which is it? Pride. And when a man starts to clean his life up, what happens? Pride starts to set in. And then, Romans 3, 9 to 18, Paul gives God's viewpoint of the world, of man. Man looks at it from one perspective, and he sees different levels or segments of society. Sees some men better than other men. But from God's perspective, it is all the same, like flying over a mountain. God will not judge on the curve. There will be an absolute judgment, because God is absolute righteousness, absolute justice, absolute holiness. So therefore, he cannot save the religious man, even though he almost crosses the chasm. Actually, this man is probably way down here in the eyes of God. We see then that man can do nothing to cross the chasm. And boy, you take this in the light of religions today, which is man's best efforts to find God. You see how they fall so short. Now, if man can do nothing to cross the chasm or the hiatus, then you tell me, when once he is saved, what can he do to remain there? If he can't do anything to cross the chasm, what can he do to stay there then? Or is it simply by the grace of God? You think about that as we go on. There wasn't a thing man could do to cross that chasm in the way of works. And what in the world can he do in the way of works, prayer, baptism, witnessing, or anything else to stay on the other side? Nothing. Purely by the grace of God. This is one reason why I believe in eternal security. Man couldn't do anything in the first place to get across there, and I don't think he'd do anything in the second place to stay there. Now, I want you to write this sentence down, and I want you to cogitate on it. Think deeply on it in the next couple of weeks. This is the key to understanding the depravity of man, the righteousness of God, and salvation. The truest thing about you is what God says. There's nothing more truthful than what God says. The truest thing about you is what God says. Or sometimes I throw it around this way. What God says about you is more true than what your five senses tell you. Write that down. What God says about you is more true than what your five senses tell you. Now, I want you to think about that. A man say, well, boy, I don't feel that sinful. But the truest thing about you is what God says, not what you feel or what you think. When it comes to salvation, it's not what your five senses tell you. It's what God tells you, which is the truest thing about you. Now go over that phrase. I didn't recommend that you'd memorize the two of them. Because as we start in, introducing substitutionary truth and identification truth, you're going to have to realize the truest thing about you is what God says, not what your five senses tell you. Verse 19 and 20, we'll be going over today the transitional period. Then in the next 2 days, we'll move through 21 to 31. Now we know that whatever the law says, it speaks to those who are under the law, that every mouth may be closed and all the world may become accountable to God. Because by the works of the law, no flesh shall be justified in his sight. For through the law comes the knowledge of sin. All right, verse 19. Now we know. Now I think here he's trying to pull the rug again out from underneath the Jew. Now we know, and he's referring to the Jew here. Now, we as Jews know. Now, what is Paul doing here? There possibly, now you picture the law court scene. Paul has presented his case. Now, the defense would stand up and would say something like this in a law court today after Paul went through Romans 3:1-18 to 3:19. The defense would stand up, say, we feel that the prosecutor has been too severe. He has judged us too much with all these things that Paul has said in quoting the Old Testament scripture from verses 10 to 18. So probably now the defense is standing up and say, just a minute. Paul, the prosecutor for God, has been too severe for us or with us. We're not all that bad. That's probably what the Jews say. Now, the reason Paul gives verses 19 and 20 is so that they may not be able to open their mouth in defense. This is why he says right there, that every mouth may be closed. He's wrapping it up now. For we know that whatever the law says, now these Jews are saying, right, we go by the law. We go by the law. It speaks to those who are under the law. Who's under the law? The Jews. Romans 2, 13 to 15, those that have the law are under the law. Those that have not the law are not under the law. That every mouth may be closed and all the world may become accountable to God. Now he goes on to verse 20 and shows why. Because, now maybe some of your translations have therefore. Any of you have a translation here that says therefore? Which translation is it? King James? Scofield? It's King James, yeah. It's better translated because. Not because, because. Because here, he is not introducing a conclusion, but is about to demolish the last stronghold of the Jews. Because by the works of the law, no flesh shall be justified in his sight. Now he's given a loose translation or paraphrase of Psalms 143 verse 2. Taken right from the Old Testament. Because by the works of law, no flesh shall be justified in his sight. Now he points out and says, look men, even the Old Testament says that no one shall be justified by the law. Now the Jews under the law. Verse 19, now we know that whatever the law says, and the Jews are saying right at that point in verse 19, right, whatever the law says to us, we believe. Paul goes on and quotes the Old Testament and says, the law cannot justify. Now you imagine what the Jew was thinking at that time. I always try to put myself in the place of the person that's being talked to. Look at what Paul would have said a short time before. Or I'll let you guess how he'd responded. Philippians 3:6. As to zeal, a persecutor of the church, as to the righteousness which is in the law, found blameless. Paul really believed that he had the righteousness of God. Think of that. He was so blinded. He so lowered the standards of God, the character of God, that he believed he fulfilled the law. Now you think, here were people just like that that Paul was talking to. Boy, they must have been mixed up inside. And then he throws in the last part of verse 20. He gives the purpose of the law. For through the law comes not righteousness, not justification. Through the law comes the knowledge of sin. Through law comes the knowledge of sin. The reason the law cannot save or produce righteousness is because it has neither the office nor the power of salvation. Its purpose is not for salvation. And it doesn't have power to save a man. In one word, Paul gives or explains the office or the purpose of salvation. To reveal sin. And we're going to look at this in a little detail because a correct understanding of this, I think, will clear up a lot of areas of your theological thinking. Paul described three types of men. The bad man, the good man, the religious man. And tells the role of law in their lives. Now the thing is, these people need to know that they are sinners. They need to know themselves. Now how does God show them, show us, show anyone in the world that we are sinners, besides just telling us? Now there are several ways that sin is revealed. It's not only by the law. One, by conscience. Romans 2, 14 to 16. Sin is revealed by conscience. read that. Where it says, in that they show the work of the law written in their hearts, their conscience bearing witness, and their thoughts alternately accusing or else defending themselves. It's accusing there, it's accusing of sin, wrongdoing. Second, sin is revealed by the gospel. Men will be judged according to the gospel. When they're judged according to the gospel, their sins will be revealed. Their sin of the rejection of Christ will be revealed. Third, sin is revealed by the Holy Spirit. John 16, verses 8 and 9. And when the Holy Spirit comes, He shall convict the world of sin. But God even gives a more objective revelation of sin. Now some of you are sitting there and say, how in the world does the law reveal sin? First of all, somebody would say this. We would say, God is holy. On a campus, a professor, a student would respond, what do you mean? God is holy. What does it mean, that phrase? What is the holiness of God? Well, God needed to communicate to man what His holiness was like. So He did it, first of all, through the Ten Commandments. That we could look at them, we could study them, and see an indication of what the holiness of God was like. And when somebody says, what do you mean, holy? What does it indicate? I read them the Ten Commandments. Then, he needed to show man that man was sick. So what did he do? He gave us a thermometer, the Ten Commandments. Now, a thermometer does what? What's the function of a thermometer? Somebody? What? In order to indicate what? In order to find out if you're sick or not. Right? That's what a thermometer's for. To find out if you're sick. Now let me ask you, can a thermometer heal you? Even if you stick it in sideways in your mouth? It can't heal you. The function or the office of a thermometer is to show you that you're sick, not to heal you. Now, the law was given to us to show us that we're sick. But it was not given to us to heal us. And this is where the Jews in the Old Testament got mixed up. They took the thermometer and tried to heal themselves with it. And it wasn't given for that. The purpose of the law is to show you that you're sick, you're a sinner. That you fall short of the glory of God. It says, love the Lord your God with all your heart. You try to do that, you don't do it, what does it show you? You fall short. That's the character of God. And you fall short of the character of God. Hemartia, the Greek word for sin, which means falling short. Now, what God had to do was this. God looked down, He saw man on the inward side, sinful. But man couldn't see himself. We cannot see ourselves from within. We can only see ourselves from without. So what God had to do was this. Show us on the outside what we're really like on the inside. And then as we see sin on the outside, we'd realize that we are a sinner on the inside. Now what's the best way to do that? He gave us a standard. The Ten Commandments. Other parts of the law. Manifestation of His holy character. And as man, as a Jew, tried to keep the Ten Commandments, he would fall short. And what did he start to realize? That there was something wrong in the inside, something that caused him to rebel. And as he started to see himself fall short of the Ten Commandments on the outward side, the purpose of it was start to cause him to realize that on the inward side, something was wrong. So the law was given to show us in the outside what we are really like on the inside. Because you see, God says man is not a product of his environment. That man has a problem. Until a man realizes he has a problem, he'll never be saved. And he will not be a part of the solution in our society today. So God gave the law. And when somebody says to me today, "What's sin?" I'll read the Ten Commandments to him. He says, how do you know I'm a sinner? I says, okay, let's go right down through the Ten Commandments. Have you done this all of your life? Have you done this all of your life? Have you done it? No, I've tried, but I've never done it. Then you're a sinner. You've fallen short of the holy, righteous character of God. Yes. Right. The Luke 10, 25 to 26, 27, 28, 29, 30. Luke 10, 25 to 29, the lawyer came to Jesus. And remember I told you there, Jesus said, okay, you go out and do it then. He says, love the Lord your God with all your heart, love your neighbor as yourself. He said, who's my neighbor? Jesus pointed out the Samaritan to him, whom the Jews hated. He says, you go out and do that and you'll fulfill the law. But he couldn't do it. So as it says right there in the scriptures, he tried to justify himself. Yeah, he couldn't do it. And what did that show him? That showed him that he had a problem on the inside. He could not keep the law. Now, the law was given to make man sin more. See? But you see, God has to drive man to desperation before he will turn to the grace of God. And so the law was given. As a man tries to fulfill the law, what happens to his transgressions? They multiply, don't they? And it drives him to desperation to respond to the grace of God. This is why in Romans, first of all, Romans 3:20 says, law comes the knowledge of sin. This is how we know about sin. We try to keep it, we can't. We see that something's wrong on the inside. But then Romans 5, 19 and 20. For as through the one man's disobedience the many were made sinners, even so through the obedience of one the many will be made righteous. And the law came in that the transgression might increase. And where sin increased, grace abounded all the more. See, if sin didn't increase much, man wouldn't rely upon the grace of God. It wouldn't drive him to desperation. But as he just started to see himself sinning more and more and more, he became more desperate. And at that time, the grace of God was able to work in his life. So the law was given, first of all, to show us on the outside what we're like on the inside. It was given as a thermometer to show us that we're sick, to drive us, to cause us to sin more, to show us our rebellious nature on the inside, and then we will respond to the grace of God. And here again, I think it dwells right down to that self-centered attitude, the rebellion of man, which it takes a while to really grasp this, that there is a law principle or a sin principle working within man. Maybe you call it rebellion. Maybe you call it self-centeredness. But there's a principle working within man that causes him to sin and rebel and hate and will never change society until that sin principle within man is broken or made ineffective. It doesn't matter what society a man lives in, how much education a man has, how much technological progress a man has. Until that sin principle is broken, we are still going to have the hate, envy, jealousy, desire for power in the world. No matter what economic system man has. And boy, a lot of people are starting to realize this is why Dr. Palmiro Togliatti, who was the head of the Italian leftist party, writing an address called The Destiny of Man, said, quote, "We no longer accept the naive and mistaken view that an increase in knowledge and a change in the social structure are enough by themselves to bring about a radical change in man." It's a communist speaking. "This view, inherited from the Enlightenment of the 18th century and Marxism of the 19th century, has been disproved by history." I'm starting to realize there's something wrong in man. This is why when, what's his name, that scientist, kind of flunky, Einstein was asked, "What do you feel the answer to the world is to the threat posed by the A-bomb?" And he retorted, "What is it that we really fear? Is it the power of the atomic bombs, or is it that force for evil within the human heart?" I think he's talking about the sin principle. The rebellion within the human heart. That must be changed. And as this is changed from within, then man can rightly, in a selfless way, respond to the society around him. This is one reason why the law was given here. To show man on the outside that he is the problem on the inside. That it's not... See, the Pharisees had the attitude that it was his environment. It was on the outside. And so therefore he could have an outward ritualism to satisfy God. God says, no, it's on the inside. You must be born again from above. Now the law condemns man. Galatians 3 says that sin, that the law is a schoolmaster to bring us to Christ. This is what the law is for. It makes us desperate, and the only thing we have to grasp to is Jesus Christ. Now, a schoolmaster was, many times it was a slave who took the child by the hand in the morning, like a school bus almost, took him to school, waited there, when school was over, brought him back. It says the law is as a slave taking you to school, but it takes you to Christ. It takes you by the hand, shows you you're desperate, shows you on the outside what you are on the inside, you can't solve your own problems, and it brings you to Christ. I know many that have come that way through the law. And the law was given to bring us to Christ. Bring us to dependence upon the grace of God and not upon our own works of salvation. Now the difference between... law and grace. I'm going to give five differences. Law emphasizes works. Faith, grace emphasizes faith. Law has the fear motivation. Grace, the love motivation. Motivated by love and not fear. Actually, grace also is motivated by fear, but a different type of fear. Not the fear that God is going to judge you for your sins, but the fear that God is going to judge those that have not received Christ. And so it drives you on in 2 Corinthians 5, where it says the love of Christ constrains us. It also says the terror, the fear of the Lord constrains us. But not the fear that He's going to strike us down, but that in the tribulation, when His wrath is unleashed. So this fear, this terror of the Lord causes us to go out and share Christ more. The law, acceptance, is based upon our performance. Under grace, based on Christ's performance. Boy, it's neat, you know, just to relax and realize that your acceptance with God is based upon Christ's performance. And boy, if any man performed, it was Jesus. He fulfilled the law. The law depends upon the flesh. Grace depends upon the Spirit. And then the law results in condemnation. This is what Paul is showing. But grace results in righteousness, being in the right with God. The law results in wickedness, being in the wrong with God. Today you ought to be thinking about the law as a thermometer. Just think about that today. Maybe rap with some other summer staff about it. And about making man sin more. You have to think that through, think it through to see that. Now what Paul is doing now in this transitional period is this. Condemns man. Man is without excuse. Man is desperate. And then gives him the solution. Now, the Roman poet Horace laid down some guidelines for writers of the tragedies in his day. He was sick and tired of everyone bringing God onto the scene too fast as a solution. And so he said this, do not bring God onto the stage unless the problem is one that deserves a God to solve it. I thought that was very smart. Do not bring God onto the stage unless the problem is such that it takes a God to solve it. Which a lot of people do that today, really think their problems through and they'd come to God. Now, Martin Luther used these words and he applied it to forgiveness of sin. He said, I have to bring God onto the scene for forgiveness of sin. And actually what Paul has done here, he's brought him right up onto the stage to the point where the only solution is bringing God onto the scene. Now I think we get a little hint of Paul's type of composition here. He touches on the law very briefly, and then he drops it. Have you kind of felt that along the way in some things? He touched in the righteousness of God in Romans 1:17, dropped it. I think this is Paul's style of composition. He touches on something, and then he drops it for full treatment later on. Kind of whets your thirst, and then he drops it, and then later on, he brings it back up. For example, the righteousness of God in Romans 1:17 he mentions, and he doesn't bring it back until Romans 8. Then he gives it full treatment. The advantage of the Jew in Romans 3, 1-14. He just touched on that and just kind of, we said a few things and then it was dropped. And then in Romans 9, 10, and 11, he comes back and gives the Jews full treatment as to their advantage. And then here he touches on the law. In just two verses, 3 verses 19 and 20. And then he drops it until Romans 7. And then he gives it full treatment. And then in Romans 6:13, he says, and do not go on presenting the members of your body to sin as instruments of unrighteousness, but present yourselves to God as those who are alive from the dead, and your members as instruments of righteousness to God. And then he just kind of leaves it until chapter 12. Where he gives it full treatment, the presentation of your bodies. And this seems to be the style that Paul uses in writing. Presents something and drops it, and it whets your appetite, and then later on he gives it full treatment. Now I need to give you a little more detailed outline of where we go from here. Put it this way. In Romans 3, Romans 3:21-5:21. This is how I write when I'm taking notes and everything. Instead of putting a colon afterwards and then 21, I put a large number for the chapter and a small number up a little for the verse, and it sure helps me when I look just like that. I see the verses and everything. I started doing this about a year ago and found it very helpful, taking notes, everything else, to write it this way instead of putting the two dots and then the big 21. This way I never get the chapters and verses mixed up when there's a line of scriptural verses. Now here we have Paul talking about justification. Justification. We're going to look at that tomorrow. You're going to see some things about justification you haven't seen before. At least I hadn't when I started studying this. And this is what we'll call substitutionary truth. Romans 3:21-5:21, justification. In other words, substitutionary truth. In the biblical term, we'll call it righteousness. Justification, substitutionary truth, or in biblical terms, righteousness. This means removal of guilt. Removal of guilt. Now underneath that, the second division, six, seven, and eight, we have sanctification. Sanctificación. Sanctification. Which is identification truth. In the biblical term, holiness. In other words, power for right living. Power for right living.